I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You worked on the Twilight Princess remake?
Yeah. It was my first experience in the industry that I actually got paid for. So there's this texture in that game that has like Hyrulean text, and each one of them corresponds to a letter of the English alphabet.
Yeah.
And so I put Jack Kirby Crosby made this, and I was like, surely QA will pick that up.
Nobody did.
They didn't pick it up.
Oh my God. Welcome to Pocket Buds, a back pocket podcast where I talk to my best buds about video games and stuff. This week, we're talking about the art of video games. Art, as we've found throughout history, can be a lot of things. It can be a painting in a gallery, a sculpture in a museum, a photo taken to capture a significant moment in time, a horny poem written in the 1700s, a 2015 album by Carly Rae Jepsen. Baby. Art exists in so many ways, but its definition and what qualifies as art is an age-old debate. So what defines art? I decided to see for myself in the Macquarie Dictionary, Australia's most trusted source for what the hell do words mean. Upon attempting to search art, I was prompted to sign into the Macquarie Dictionary website. Back in the day, you could simply open the dictionary in your hands. How times have changed. So I went to create an account, as one does, as I was desperate to learn the true meaning of art. This then led to the Macquarie Dictionary insisting that I pay $50 a year to read the dictionary. If you think that's a bit much, the Oxford English Dictionary asks for £100 a year. That's almost 200 in dinky dye dollary dues. I then recalled that a City of Sydney library membership is free and gives me more than just the dictionary to borrow from my local library. So I got a library membership. At this point, you're probably assuming that I went to my local library and picked up the latest dictionary. Of course I didn't do that, as that would require me getting up and going somewhere, and I didn't want to. So instead, I checked on the City of Sydney's e-library. The E stands for electronic. Perhaps they had a digital version of the dictionary. Ding dong, I was wrong. However, they did have a bunch of other kinds of dictionaries, so I learned some pretty cool stuff. Did you know that the word for artist in the language of the Wiradjuri people is bundadine? Well, now you do. While I did learn something, I still hadn't found what I was looking for. Thankfully, the Cambridge Dictionary has a free website. Here's what it says. They define art as the making of objects, images, music, etc. that are beautiful or that express feelings, or an activity through which people express particular ideas. Again, free of charge. You get what you pay for. The questioning of whether or not a certain thing is art or part of the arts has been going on for a while now. There was even a time when music and film were questioned as art forms, with music in particular only being officially considered one of the arts in 1746, despite cave people dropping fat beats by whacking two dino femurs together since the homos became erectus. Can I say homos? It was probably because they hadn't yet heard Carly Rae Jepsen's 2015 masterpiece, Emotion. This, of course, all leads to now, and the most recent entry in the Is This Thing Art competition, video games. To quite a few vocal critics, video games are not art.
Oh.
This is due to the way that said critics see art and what falls into that definition. Some of the main arguments against video games as an art form generally look to their existence as commodities, the concept of experience first and meaning later, and even the idea that true art should not be interactive, but rather just viewed. To look at games and their capability to be art, purely through the act of viewing them, aka their visual design, would be diminishing how storytelling, interactivity, and even music also play an important role to portray meaning. Every piece plays a role in creating a piece of art, similarly to film. However, there are also games that exist solely as artistic visual experiences, and sometimes the art within video games can be pointed to as examples of video games not just as an art form, but also as a space to house art itself. So joining me today to talk about the art direction of video games, the process of making art for video games, and how video games exist in the arts is the art lead for Wooden Weather and art director of Moving Out 2, and also my friend, Jack Kirby Crosby. Jack, how are you feeling today?
Wonderful. That was a great introduction, I thought.
Thank you. It was originally 1,500 words long and had a lot to say about Roger Ebert, but we're going to get to him later.
I had the thought while you were talking about it. I was like, Roger Ebert, is he dead?
He's dead.
Yeah,
he's
well, so we won, didn't we? So
we won. We're still here. Yeah,
right.
Video games are still here, but films are here too. So in a way, Roger Ebert also won. Mm. But like, you know, he was all right. I think he's a really interesting case of like, he changed his mind.
Did he?
Well, it was funny because how it kind of started was he saw Doom in 2005, like the Doom movie.
Really?
Yeah. And he reviewed it. He gave a 1-star review for it and was like, if this is video games, oh boy.
What I think is really interesting about that conversation is like Roger Ebert kind of pushed video games a lot. Like he pushed us as a medium to kind of really introspect on that thought. And like when that debate was kind of at its heaviest, I think my stance on it was always like, yeah, of course they're art, but we should be asking ourselves, are they good art? And more often than not, I think the answer to that question is probably not. Like,
No. His ending statement wasn't really video games are art, but instead was, I'm never going to play a video game, so who am I to judge?
Wow. I like to think that's what he said on his deathbed. Like, he's just kind of like,
I'll never play a video game.
Yeah, exactly.
I respect that, honestly. Yeah.
And
to be that petty.
Exactly. But it is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because it sounds like he just kind of didn't really care that much. He was just like, there's this other medium that's happening. And I'm like, I don't know, it's not relevant to me.
He's literally like, I got so many movies to watch.
Yeah.
You mentioning that he kind of pushed video game developers to expand video games as an art form. Like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I feel like, and without sounding cringe, and I will in this moment, but it's ironic, so it's fine that I say it, the haters make you stronger, right?
Yeah.
They force you to grow and change.
I mean, it's kind of basic, like, art school stuff, right? Like,
oh yeah,
you need to go through critique to kind of be able to see your own work through a different light. And I think basically video games is, as a medium for a very long time, has been fairly kind of blinkered as to like other mediums are not really.
Yeah.
There's obviously a whole bunch of game directors that really want to be filmmakers, and that's fine. But like it's very kind of like, oh, defensive of itself as a medium. And like I think that having someone from another medium who cares deeply about an art form and art as a concept, saying like, hey, this isn't doing it for me, is like, it's important. Like,
totally.
Really, really kind of need that sort of voice to be counter to the overwhelming narrative that games has that's just like,
totally,
we're sick. Because
we're so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, like the video game world has become quite insular. Mm-hmm. In the sense that it's just like we used to have Roger Ebert's kind of critiquing but also willing to change their minds. Now you got folks like Jonathan Jones, who's the Guardian art critic, who still to this day is like, video games are not art. They are dumb. Professors should not be playing them. And it's funny as hell. Like he's like, video games are for children. Stupid. Shut the hell up. Also gave a critique to The Birth of Venus, which I think is such a like classic work of art that like I don't think that needs an art critique. Like, mm-hmm. leave her in the past. She's beautiful and amazing. But like, he also shares a name with the pirate shark from Super Mario RPG, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
And maybe like calmer a little bit, but he is very hardcore, like video games are not art and they never will be. And that is because art is only traditional art. And I feel like there seems to be this disconnect between art critics like Jones and the video games industry. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that comes from?
Games as a medium, like it actively presents itself as a product.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're making them, we're thinking about who our target market is, what the intention of it as a way to make money is. And I think that's probably true of film as well, but it is very, I think it's very difficult to have a conversation about art forms and how they express themselves in the broader community and culture if your overwhelming substantial worry is about whether or not your game is going to make any money.
Yeah.
And so much of games criticism and reviews and stuff is reviewing it as a product. Am I getting my money's worth out of this 40-hour experience? And
yeah,
which, you know, like is fair enough. Like I strongly believe in consumer rights.
And consumer wrongs. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also like that's, and I think it's a difficult conflict that we have where we're like, we want to be art, but then also we also want to be a product. And
yeah,
and that conflict of like, hey, we're art, and then also like, leave my video game alone, it's my favorite thing, it birthed me or whatever. It's like,
yeah,
it's difficult.
I mean, I feel like we're definitely in an age where like there is a subset of people where if you say a Marvel movie is garbage, that subset of people is going to act like you've slaughtered their firstborn in front of you.
Yeah.
In front of them. But like, I think that to me is like a very specific subset of people who watch movies. Video games is that times a million.
Absolutely.
If you criticize a video game that somebody loves deeply, depending on the kind of person they are, more people who are into video games are going to feel like it is a personal attack on them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I think it actually leads into how Roger Ebert defines art. Because he struggled. He struggled to find a definition of art that he was happy with. He would have been happy with a definition of art that very clearly stated that video games did not count, which I find so interesting. That's what he was looking for.
Yeah, right.
He didn't find that.
Right.
Instead, he found lots of different open-ended stuff. Or stuff that purely just said paintings and sculpture. And due to him being a film critic, that's not going to work for him.
Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah, right? Oh, no.
It would have been wild if, like, games people were just, like, actually just cutting his quotes. And it was just like, games are not art, but also it turns out film is not either, so.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm here to do. That's what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert was wrong. But he was kind of right as well. He had some good points. One of his good points was the way that he views art and, like, his personal definition for it, which basically was like a few factors that went into like how he felt.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very much the piece of art helps you learn more about the experiences, thoughts, and feelings of other people. It engages your empathy. It teaches you lessons to apply to yourself and your relationships to others, instructs you about life, love, disease, and death, principles and morality, humor and tragedy, and makes your life more deep, full and rewarding. Mm. And that's his definition that definitely applies to film. Funnily enough, in my opinion, that absolutely applies to video games.
Yeah.
And I would argue on even a somewhat deeper level, because there is that interactivity that puts you into it. So you're forced to empathize because you're basically there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's their most powerful use, really, is transportation of experience and their ability to have you experience the act of doing the thing, you know, like, and that's, yeah, obviously you're holding the controller, but like, I think that is like, I mean, it is the defining thing of video games. And I also think it's just it's a highly collaborative art form that forces different disciplines, different ideas to come together and think as one to produce something that hopefully your players or the people consuming the art experience the way you want them to. And I think also, like, we have so much infrastructure in games to make sure that we are delivering on that idea of, like, you know, are we actually delivering on the experience that we want our players to go through? And yeah, I would agree with that immensely. I mean, I'm trying to think of like games that have done that for me, like giving me a profound sense of emotion. I cried in Horizon Forbidden West.
Oh, yeah.
I won't spoil it. But I wasn't expecting to be moved quite so greatly by that piece of media. It was, but it did. And that's like a, we know, like a $200-300 million production that, like,
had barely so, hundreds of people working on it.
Yeah. Like, how they do that? I don't know. That's
what
wild.
A hell! What a freaking hell! How did video even get? Video game even get made? Oh my god!
What?
It's crazy.
I think maybe there's some more parallels between past eras of artistic expression and now. You know, if you think about like the Renaissance, the artists back then were not making art for themselves. Like, it was not like the concept of personal work was not really a thing.
No.
Paint was way too expensive to just be like frivolously painting whatever you wanted.
Lots of commissions.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if you could think of the big players in video games these days kind of operating under similar circumstances. Like, the cost of making a big AAA video game is just so inconceivably large that that there's just no way that like a single person could do that. And it's so inherently tied to a capitalist sort of ideal of expression. and so inherently at that large scale, I think there's a real limit to the breadth of expression that you can have, because you know where you're bread is buttered. And I think that's probably true on the indie scale as well. Like, we're very beholden to publishers and that sort of thing as well.
I feel like so many games have started as one thing and ended as another due to the fact that, one, it's a collaborative process, not just between the developers, but also with the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately you are making something that's going to make two parties money, the developer and the publisher.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. So they, you know, you do have to probably take some creative liberties. Maybe like not when you're publishing independently, but, you know, that's just one way to do it, right? If you've got the money to keep it going.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I think to counter my point a little bit, I think that, you know, even in the Renaissance, artists were finding ways to put their own expression within these commissions, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's probably even more true of video games now. Like, there's always someone at the bottom of the chain just sneaking something in there, you know, and it's kind of beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I do wonder if there's, like, there's a certain part of it on the creator's part where you kind of put stuff in there expecting it to get picked up.
Surely, right?
I've certainly done that.
Tell us about it.
So there was this video game called Twilight Princess that was remade, and I worked on it.
Whoa, hold on. Sorry. Step back.
Yeah.
You worked on the Twilight Princess remake?
Yeah. Yeah, that was like one of my first. That was one of my first.
How did I know that about you?
Yeah, it's, I don't.
Friends learn new things about each other, and I think that's beautiful.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I don't talk about it too much because it was like, it was my first experience in the industry and as like that I actually got paid for, which back then was a big deal, getting paid for working on video games.
Absolutely.
And like, so there's this texture in that game that has like Hyrulean text or whatever. It's like different symbols and stuff. And each one of them corresponds to a letter of the English alphabet. Yep. And so I was like looking over this thing and working really hard on this thing. Like it's a big deal for me, little young Jack working on this little video game.
Oh my God, of course.
And I'm translating it like A, okay, yeah, cool. B, yeah, nice. C, D, E. Oh, it's just the alphabet. It's just the alphabet. That's really frustrating. Oh. I was very annoyed.
You're like, this makes so much sense. Yeah. Now. I've just learned how to read. This is awesome.
Yeah. And so I put my name in the texture instead. I was like, Jack Kirby Crosby made this. And I was like, surely QA will pick that up. Surely. It's Nintendo.
Nobody did.
They'll pick it up. They didn't pick it up.
No.
And the consequences of that are all over the internet.
That is like writing your name on a school desk.
Yeah.
But then that school gets demolished and everything inside gets crushed 100 years later, 1,000 years later even, actually, probably more like 1,000 years later, they find it.
Yeah.
And they find that desk and they find your name and they're like, whoa.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's what kids were doing back in school. Now we don't have school. We have robot children.
Yeah.
And
the robot children have got names written all over their circuit boards. It's
They all say Jack Kirby Crosby was here. Because you happen to design these robots and you're like, yeah. All right. I'll go for it.
This, I'm annoyed. I'm putting my name on this thing.
Honestly, if I could have a job in the robotic revolution, I'd be fine with that. If the robots were like, we'll spare you, mm-hmm. you just have to work for us, I'd be like, all right.
I mean, they might be more even-handed, wouldn't they? Like they're at least going to operate by the laws. So
I honestly think, and this is going to sound insane.
Okay.
I think I would probably much rather work under a robot overlord mm-hmm. Than I would any real person currently running a government in this current day and age, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. I don't know. There's some good ones. Like maybe like
yeah.
It's hard to name them.
Yeah.
Like Lula da Silva in Brazil, he seems all right.
Yeah, the Brazil, he does seem all right.
But I don't know, like I probably wouldn't want to work for him.
No.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it does depend on, I guess, the beliefs of whoever made it.
Because
the thing is like with all this AI stuff, I feel like ultimately what it comes down to is the AI is never going to make a decision for itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's all dependent on the information that it's getting, but also who made it and their thoughts and feelings, because they're the one programming it, and they're not going to program it to be like, I need this robot to be racist. Like they're not, obviously that's not going to, well, they might, but yeah, like well. The point is like they're programming it with their inherent bias existing within themselves. So that means it's going to represent some of the thoughts and feelings that they have. Right.
Yeah. I mean, we know that, right? Like there's huge amounts of bias in the AI imagery that we're seeing that like you type in doctor and it's like a white man in a thing, and you type in nurse and it's like
it's a woman always.
Yeah. I mean, I say you type, I've never actually done the typing in the thing. I think it's not really, it's not really interested me, but like,
I mean, you're an artist.
Yeah, it's like I obviously despise it as a concept. I think the whole idea of like outsourcing what is one of the most joyous things you can do as a human on this planet to a robot is just like abhorrent. But like,
especially when there's just millions of people in the world who are willing to do that art.
Yeah. Oh, and you know? If you're at that point, just like draw something yourself. And I think I think maybe as humans, we want to make good stuff. Maybe that's ultimately what Roger Ebert's getting at. Like, I want you to make good stuff.
Yeah.
But also, like, there's value in just doing a scribble or a doodle. Like, that's viable art. And yeah. Totally.
And it's interesting as well, because there's this idea that, like, why would you want to practice and get better when you could just write out some words and have an art pop up for you? And suddenly you're an artist. Insane mindset, by the way. Like that is, I think, probably one of the world's greatest delusions that we've currently got going on. And there's a lot. There's a lot of delusional people out there. But, like, one of the greatest ones is people putting in a prompt and being like, yeah, I'm an AI artist. Like, no, you're a writer. Gosh. You're a writer of words. The words don't make sense as a sentence, but as a sequence that is a prompt, they make sense. Mm-hmm. But I think what's really interesting is they call themselves artists, and they do have this mindset that, like, what they're doing is creating. And it's because they want, one, they want to make something beautiful, and two, they want to do it without putting in the time and effort that it takes, because they think that being able to make beautiful art comes inherently and isn't something that is trained. I didn't watch actually. I saw the thumbnail of a PewDiePie video recently.
Okay.
And he drew every day for 100 days.
PewDiePie
And I
did.
Saw in the thumbnail, PewDiePie did, yes.
Wow.
And I saw in the thumbnail that he had one picture on day one, which kind of looked, it looked like a 13-year-old's learning to draw manga from one of those, like,
for sure, yeah,
books, right? And then 100 days later, a very good drawing. And that, to me, I saw that and I'm like, well, it's just practice. Like, it's just teaching yourself and practicing. And people, I feel like the internet has kind of warped our minds into believing in immediate validation
for absolutely
everything.
Yeah.
And that includes art.
Yeah, I think that's a really pertinent observation. I think there is, like, a real instant gratification that we want from the internet and then life in general, you know, like, it's very
totally,
very much a thing of the modern era. And that's, I wouldn't necessarily put a value judgment on that. I work in video games. Like, that's kind of what we do. But at the same time, I kind of just feel sad for these folks who are missing out on that experience. Like, that's a beautiful story of PewDiePie.
It's a delightful, better story of PewDiePie than you hear.
I hadn't heard that one. That's a nice one. PewDiePie. Yeah. Assume it gets, like, weirdly racist at some point, but, like, it's
apparently not.
Yeah, not on this one. That's God. Great.
Thank God. So I consume, which is just terrible, but I do consume, and I consume a lot. I love media. I love watching YouTube. I want to put so much information in my brain that it eventually grows larger than my head and explodes. I just want to learn stuff.
You're getting close.
Thank you. That means a lot. But I also just like knowing shit that I don't have any business knowing. Like, it doesn't matter in the long run. Something that, like, if I walked up to a regular old friend of mine and started talking to them about it, they'd be like, who the fuck is Trisha Paytas? What are you talking about? Why are you saying this to me right now? That's the kind of information that I want to know.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think another interesting thing with Roger Ebert, though, he never played a video game.
Yeah.
And it's believed that despite him kind of implying that he maybe wanted to play Shadow of the Colossus, I don't think he did.
Yeah.
But he was aware that he did say, I can't not watch a movie and judge it. I have to watch the movie to judge it. Therefore, if I'm never going to play a video game, I cannot judge them and their worth. Do you think that playing video games, especially ones with like a strong artistic focus, kind of plays a pivotal role in people being able to see them for their artistic worth?
Yeah, probably. I think, you know, playing games with my partner, like I find it very hard to convince her to play games that are not visually appealing to her. I mean, maybe I have a vested interest in that being true. But yeah, I think the artistic quality of a video game, I mean, it's, if you want to look at it in a purely kind of crass, cynical way, is kind of the advertising of a video game. You make the visuals of it and hopefully you're making it for an audience that finds that appealing. And we've seen that over the generations of consoles, this sort of pursuit of greater and more realistic graphics or whatever. And you see people who don't necessarily engage with aesthetic critique critiquing, and maybe in a more like less nuanced way, but really, really looking at the way that a video game appeals to them. And I think we talk about in games a lot, like there's things that players feel rather than that they necessarily see.
Mm.
And because everything you make in a video game has to be made from scratch, everything has to be considered and everything has to be looked at from every particular angle that it will be looked at by the audience. And so nothing is ever, like there are obviously mistakes, but they're mistakes that have been chosen to be ignored. You know, like I remember back in the day when I started really playing video games, because I only really started playing video games in uni, that my experience of them was from a point of view of critiquing them from, oh, these are the things I would do differently, and finding them difficult, or I'm struggling to find a word, like crunchy, or like not enjoyable to play, or like the visuals not appealing to me personally. I find that much more difficult to accept. Whereas now, having made or contributed to the making of quite a few video games at this point, I kind of see mistakes in there and I'm like, hell yeah, dude, don't fix that. That's so good. That's so good.
Bug, like, baby, that's
no one cares. About. That's great. But like, I think it's interesting as you watch like an audience, and our audience predominantly is younger people, and so they don't have as broad an aesthetic experience, like naturally. Mm. And so the thing that they're interested in is, does this look like outside? Like, does it feel real? And I think maybe that's why we have pursued realism in this industry at the expense of all else. But ultimately, that is the thing that they're looking at. They see a trailer. They're not playing the trailer. Like, it's a visual experience that you first have with a video game. And so I think, people's enjoyment of a video game can ultimately be make or break based on its visuals.
Because it's your first impression.
Yeah.
It's the first thing that you take in, right?
Yeah.
And you've been doing that for a while. I find it really interesting that you started playing video games in uni.
It's not entirely true. Like I did play some games when I was a kid, but it was mostly sitting on the couch watching other people play because I was like kind of intimidated by them. I was like, I'm not very good at them. We never had a console at home. And so the access to that was not immediate. I think I played Zumbinis a lot. On PC.
Sick.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a pretty deep cut. and then I played a lot of Black and White, which is Lionhead's god game.
Mm, mm.
But that was kind of it. I didn't really, I loved video games, and whenever I went over to friends' houses, I'd be like, "Can we play video games? Like, this is sick." But I got my first console, which was a PlayStation 3, I think. Yeah, it was a PlayStation 3 before uni, because I was like, "Well, I'm gonna," because I studied games design. It's like, I better learn about these video games.
What the hell is it?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I kind of, that was where I started with games playing.
Yeah, and so you went into uni with game design in mind, and I have to assume that you were doing quote unquote traditional art before that, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you find making art outside of video games versus for/within video games differs?
It's kind of what you said earlier, that like it's a collaborative medium. And I find it really hard to make work for myself these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because the thing that I enjoy the most in creating art is collaboration and having conversations about it and coming together and finding the meeting between two people or three people or 10 people, whatever. And I think there's a level of difficulty that comes with that that's interesting and I find juicy, and it's really satisfying coming to the other side of an aesthetic problem, because you know how you arrived at that, because it's the joining of minds, which, you know, I find really enjoyable. And so I think for my traditional art, the stuff that I sort of post online or whatever, a lot of it is I come to through social media. And I think maybe there's an element to that where it's like I feel a sense of collaboration there, like posting and, you know, process and early parts of a painting and then having feedback from an audience and being like, oh, this is kind of, they might find not enjoy it early on when it's just a scribble, and then watching that process grow, and is a bit more of a collaboration there, I think. And so, I mean, the other thing is I'm just like, these days I'm just so busy. I just don't have a huge amount of time to make art for myself. So maybe I'm just coping. Maybe it's just like, I would like to do more of my own stuff, but I just don't have time.
That's the thing. I was talking to a musician friend of mine the other night, and it's very interesting hearing the opinions of different people in different areas of the arts.
Sure, yeah.
Kind of having really similar experiences of like, sure, if you do what you love, you never have to work a day in your life. That's the old saying, absolutely. But if you do what you love for your work, and what you love happens to be a creative venture, there is such a thing as creative energy. And if you're putting all of that into your work, or at least most of it, it's so hard to come home or just get out of work and feel the ability to make your own things.
Yeah.
And it's not so much like, I don't know if I completely call it a bad thing, because, you know, you still have the ability to create, but it's definitely rough. It definitely makes you wish you had unlimited energy. Like, I used to make like 3 comics a day, and now I can do like 1 every 3 months.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing of like, well, I put so much creative energy into my work, but I also love my job.
Yeah.
Like it's the dream. So
yeah.
It's a, yeah, it's woe a funny is me. Thing, man. Yeah. Oh, my life's so hard. I get to do what I love for my job. Yeah. But I think that's the creative's, the creative's folly is the ideal is that our work is something that we're passionate about, because I feel like creative work's only really valued if you're making money out of it at the end of the day, especially in this capitalist hellscape.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, like, it was a conscious decision that I made to get into video games, because I was like, oh, it looks like that's a way to pursue creativity and actually have a living.
Yeah.
The 2 years post-university where I didn't earn a single cent kind of put a dampener on that idea, but and like I had some good years at Grilled, and by good years I mean 6 months.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen. Shout out JB.
I exactly. Love it is hard, but I find my creative pursuits in other things I do. Like, you know, I have a podcast and like I do writing for it and that, I mean, that takes up a significant amount of time and as I'm sure you know.
I know all too well.
And the other thing is like for most of my career, like I've mostly been a freelance artist and since COVID as well, where I'm working at this computer that I'm talking to you from, it's hard to sit down at it and do creative work.
Yeah.
In the same way that I find it hard to sit at this computer and play video games. Like the concept of doing that just like makes me, like I find it horrific. Whereas like I have a couch right next to me.
And like I hate having fun.
Like sitting there and playing the TV behind me, fine. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's workstation and there's fun station.
That's right.
And they're two different things.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, sometimes they kind of come together and it's confusing and kind of horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. I don't know what the solution for that is. Like maybe probably having an office, and probably that is a good way to have separation between work and life. But I like so much of creative industry is like putting your all into it, and you know that's why it's an incredibly exploited industry. Is like, we ultimately do really like being here, but it's you know. And that's really, it turns out really juicy for capitalists.
Oh, yeah. It's like, I love my job. There's tears running down my face. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. Well, that's all the time we got.
Mm.
But what's a game that comes to mind for you as a game that you would consider to be art?
I think a lot about like Disco Elysium. I think,
I
know it was a sort of pretty troubled experience for those developers and
still is.
But goodness gracious, that is a beautiful video game.
Oh my God, yeah.
My work is very detailed and like I'm like my personal work. Mm. More often than not, I have like clients being like, so you do like not very detailed stuff as well, yeah? And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. We don't have to put all the detail in. But I really love that in Disco Elysium, they're like, fuck it, we're just going full detail and it's like, we're just going to put these beautiful patterns everywhere and it's like every frame of that video game is just astonishingly beautiful aesthetically and you feel the world building in it. I love it. It's just delightful.
It is so hyper detailed in multiple different ways. Like visually, yes, but God, in its storytelling.
Mm.
Like
I still haven't finished it, by the way.
Yeah. Me neither.
Yeah.
Me neither. But
you
can still see it for the work of art that it is.
Yeah.
God, absolutely. Yeah.
There's so many video games. Like
too many.
Yeah. I really loved Chance of Sinar last year. Like I thought.
Yeah.
I finished that with my partner. I thought that was just like what an incredible way to explore language. Like my partner's background is Sri Lankan and I thought that video game just in a really special way talked about the ways that language can propagandize and like change the way that we think about things and getting to read the different languages and see the way that they talk about each other through othering of each other and just very special video game, I thought.
Oh, yeah. I felt very similar but different about Venba. From last year, which I thought was such a beautiful experience in so many different ways, really speaks to Roger Ebert when he was like, a work of art should engage your empathy.
Mm.
And that game, oh my God, that throws you just right into the deep end of losing your connection to culture. Through, I'd say, forced assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, that is such a beautiful game because it's done in such a fascinating way just through cooking mini games, which I thought were fantastic. And the pages get muddied so you can't fully see them and you're relying on your memory of these dishes. Oh, God, what a special experience.
And the way that it kind of explores, like, not being able to understand your parents and like
oh my God, yeah.
That was another one. Like, talking of games that make you cry, it's like
I bawled like a baby.
Yeah, just wild how much empathy and pathos and expression that video game has. It's
it's only 2 hours long, and
absolutely flooring. Like, just
incredible.
If more video game, like, God, it's that is a high standard to live up to in video games. I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jack, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
You're welcome.
How can we find out more about your work?
Yeah, you can just follow me on the gram at JK Crosby Fun. I'm on Twitter and stuff as well. I've been taking a minor hiatus from Twitter for 3 months.
Fair enough.
And it's been beautiful.
I'm sure it's
but
been
I will
awesome.
I will return eventually. And then I'm basically JK Crosby Fun all over the internet. So I've got a podcast called Dice Paper Roll, R-O-L-E, and we're going to be doing 4 shows in the Comedy Festival, playing live Dungeons and Dragons, where like last year I did a Dungeons and Dragons show with Mish Wittrup, who was our guest. And I did, at the time I was moving, and I did the whole show about landlords and trying to move out of a property and and get it. It was, and at the end
you draw from your personal experiences.
That's right. Yeah.
You
know? Yeah, and because that week I was moving and also working on a video game called Moving Out 2, and and so I really drew from experience, and it was delightful. So we'd really love for people to come. We do things a little differently with D&D. So yeah.
Gorgeous. And what are the dates for those?
During the Comedy Festival, Melbourne International Delightful. Comedy Festival. Just look it up.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look up Dice Paper Roll.
Yeah.
And that's R-O-L-E.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll find the dates.
Yes.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Jack, thank you so much for joining me today on the show. It's been really great having you.
Thanks, Ruby. Very fun. Anytime.
And a big thank you to you for listening. If you're liking what you're hearing, you'd like to hear more, consider supporting Back Pocket over on Patreon. If you support us at the silver tier and above, you can get access to our bonus episodes. In this week's bonus episode, I'm joined by Gus to talk about the games that we consider to be works of art. I start saying something and I distinctly hear you going, here we go.
Yeah. It's like getting on a roller coaster. Everyone goes, here we go.
The thing is, you don't want to stay on a roller coaster.
It does
forever.
Make you sick after
a while. Yeah. Oh, eventually you vomit and maybe get some kind of brain damage. Would you say that that's similar to talking to me?
That's exactly what it is.
All right. And hey, if you really like what you're hearing, why not give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using? Better yet, why not give us a nice little review? You can also find us on Twitch, where we've got our main live show every Thursday from 7 p.m. And on TikTok, where we're constantly posting very good stuff for you to cast your big, beautiful eyes on. And then there's the socials, all our Twitter and threads and whatever, which you're also welcome to get around. Once again, thanks so much for tuning in. And as the late Johann Wolfgang von Goethe would say, bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited-edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.